Penguin Random House Audio presents The Innocent Man, Part 1, by Pamela Koloff, from Texas Monthly, November 2012. Read for you by Stacy Snell. 1. On April 12, 1987, Michael Morton sat down to write a letter. "Your Honor," he began, "I'm sure you remember me. I was convicted of murder in your court in February of this year." He wrote each word carefully, sitting cross-legged on the top bunk in his cell at the Wynn Prison Unit in Huntsville. "I have been told that you are to decide if I am ever to see my son Eric again. I haven't seen him since the morning that I was convicted. I miss him terribly, and I know that he has been asking about me." Referring to the declarations of innocence he had made during his trial, he continued, "I must reiterate my innocence. I did not kill my wife. You cannot imagine what it is like to lose your wife the way I did, then to be falsely accused and convicted of this terrible crime. First my wife, and now possibly my son. Sooner or later, the truth will come out. The killer will be caught, and this nightmare will be over. I pray that the sheriff's office keeps an open mind. It is no sin to admit a mistake. No one is perfect in the performance of their job. I don't know what else to say, except I swear to God that I did not kill my wife. Please don't take my son from me, too." His windowless concrete cell, which he shared with another inmate, measured 5 by 9 feet. If he extended his arms, he could touch the walls on either side of him. A small metal locker that was bolted to the wall contained one of the few remnants he still possessed from his previous life, a photograph of Eric when he was 3 years old, taken shortly before the murder. The boy was standing in the backyard of their house in Austin, playing with a windsock, grabbing the streamers that fluttered behind it in the breeze. There was a picture, too, of his late wife, Christine, a candid shot Michael had taken of her years earlier, with her hair pinned up, still wet from a bath. She was looking away from the camera, but she was smiling slightly, her fingers pressed against her mouth. The crime scene photos were still fresh in Michael's mind, but if he focused on the snapshot, the horror of those images abated. Christine with damp hair, smiling. This was how he wanted to remember her. The last time he had seen her was on the morning of August 13, 1986, the day after his 32nd birthday. He had glanced at her as she lay in bed, asleep, before he left for work around 5:30. He returned home that afternoon to find the house cordoned off with yellow crime scene tape. 6 weeks later, he was arrested for her murder. He had no criminal record, no history of violence, and no obvious motive. But the Williamson County Sheriff's Office, failing to pursue other leads, had zeroed in on him from the start. Although no physical evidence tied him to the crime, he was charged with first-degree murder. Prosecutors argued that he had become so enraged with Christine for not wanting to have sex with him on the night of his birthday that he had bludgeoned her to death. When the guilty verdict was read, Michael's legs buckled beneath him. District Attorney Ken Anderson told reporters afterward, "Life in prison is a lot better than he deserves." The conviction had triggered a bitter custody battle between Christine's family, who, like many people in Michael's life, came to believe that he was guilty, and Michael's parents. The question of who would be awarded custody of Eric was to be resolved by State District Judge William Lott, who had also presided over Michael's trial. If Christine's family won custody, Michael was justifiably concerned that he would never see his son again. 2 weeks after sending his first entreaty to Lott, Michael penned another letter. "My son has lost his mother," he wrote. Psychological good can come from seeing his one surviving parent. Ultimately, custody of the boy was awarded to Christine's younger sister, Mary Lee Kirkpatrick. But at the recommendation of a child psychiatrist who felt that Eric should know his father, Lott agreed to allow 2 supervised visits a year. Mary Lee drove Eric to Huntsville every 6 months to see his father. He was 4 when the visits began. At first, Eric was oblivious to his surroundings. He raced his matchbox cars along the plastic tabletops in the visitation area, mimicking the sounds of a revving engine. He talked about the things he loved: dinosaurs, comic books, astronomy, his dog. As he grew older, he described the merit badges he had earned in Boy Scouts and his Little League triumphs. Mary Lee always sat beside him, her impassive expression impossible to decipher. For Eric's sake, she seemed determined to make the mandated reunions, which she had strenuously opposed, as normal as possible. She flipped through magazines as Eric and his father spoke, sometimes glancing up to join in. Michael tried to pretend there was nothing unusual about the arrangement either, dispensing lemon drops he had purchased at the prison commissary and talking to his son about the Astros' ups and downs or the Oilers' failed attempts at a comeback. During the months that stretched between visits, he wrote letters to Eric, but Mary Lee did not encourage the correspondence, and it remained a one-way conversation. Over the years, as Eric got older, Michael would try not to register surprise at each new haircut and growth spurt, but the changes always startled him. He was dumbstruck the first time he heard Eric call Mary Lee Mom. The boy's memories of his mother had by then receded. "Of course, I have lost him," Michael wrote in his journal after one visit when Eric was 10. "He knows little or nothing of me, or the short time we spent together." Around the time Eric turned 13, the tenor of their visits changed. Eric was distant and impatient to leave. Michael knew that the boy had started asking questions. During a trip to East Texas to see his paternal grandparents, he had asked if it was true that his father had killed his mother. Fearful of alienating Eric any further, Michael never tried to engage him in a conversation about the case or persuade him that he had been wrongfully convicted. He assumed that Mary Lee would contradict any argument he made, and he doubted Eric would believe him anyway. The silences that stretched between them became so agonizing that Michael often found himself turning to Mary Lee to make conversation. 2 hours were allotted for their visits, but that was an eternity. "Well," Mary Lee would say when they ran out of small talk. "Yes," Michael would agree. "It's probably time." Their last meeting was so brief that Eric and Mary Lee barely sat down. Eric, who was 15, was unable to look Michael in the eye. "I don't want to come here anymore," he choked out. Michael considered thanking Mary Lee for turning his son against him, or telling Eric that everything he had been led to believe was a lie. But as he looked at his son, who stared hard at the floor, he kept those thoughts to himself. "I'm not going to force you to come see me," Michael told him. "You can come back any time if you change your mind." Before he walked away, he said to Mary Lee, "Take good care of my son for me." 2. When Michael and Christine bought the house on Hazelhurst Drive in 1985, Northwest Austin had not yet been bisected by toll roads or swallowed up by miles of unbroken suburban sprawl. The real estate bust had brought construction to a standstill, and the half-built subdivision where they lived, east of Lake Travis, was a patchwork of new homes and uncleared, densely wooded lots. Although the Morton home had an Austin address, it sat just north of the Travis County line in Williamson County, an area that, despite an incursion of new residents and rapid development, still retained the rural feel and traditional values of small-town Texas. Austin was seen as morally permissive, a refuge for dope-smoking and liberal politics that Williamson County, which prided itself on its law and order reputation, stood against. In Georgetown, the county seat, bars and liquor stores were prohibited. Their neighborhood was a place for newcomers, most of them young professionals with children. The Mortons arrived when Eric was a toddler, and Christine had quickly learned everyone's name on their street, often stopping in the driveway after work to visit with the neighbors. Friendly and unguarded, with long brown hair and bright blue eyes, she had a disarming confidence. She might squeeze the arm of the person she was talking to as she spoke, or punctuate conversation with a boy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?